Ladies and gentlemen, in our first lecture, we discussed the rather curious relationship between the individual life and the public, biological, historical life of man. In the lectures which follow, I shall talk about the individual. I shall try to pose and answer the question, who precisely are we? What sort of creature is this human being? Are we, for example, a soul imprisoned within a body? Are we, as Descartes says, a completely individualized ego whose essence is consciousness and who is related only to one part of matter within the body, and the matter being entirely of another class of reality, having as its essence only extension? Or are we, as modern empiricists are inclined to believe, a monistic mind-body? Is the self completely insulated from all other selves? Or is there some kind of psychic medium in which all selves bathe, in which means that the individual is not totally cut off from other minds? All these are questions which we shall have to consider in some detail later on. But what I want to start with in this lecture is the manner in which people in the past have thought about the problem of human nature. The terms in which they discuss the problem are, of course, very different from the terms in which we discuss it. Nevertheless, I think it's worthwhile making this historical detour, because when we examine what people have thought in the past about themselves, about the nature of man, we find that it does throw a great deal of light on the problem, and it's very interesting to see how men have dealt with fundamentally the same facts in terms of different frames of theoretical reference. Well, I shall begin by talking about the theory of man, such as we find in the wellspring of Western civilization, that is to say, in the Homeric poems. And I think the best way of starting is to read a passage from the 19th book of the Iliad. In the 19th book, the terrible quarrel between Agamemnon and Achilles is made up. Agamemnon apologizes to Achilles for having taken away his girl, Briseis, and explains why he did this thing which enraged Achilles so much. And he says, I was not to blame. It was Zeus and my lot and the fury that walks in the darkness that blinded my judgment that day when I confiscated Achilles' girl. What could I do? At such moments, there is a power that takes command, Ate, the eldest daughter of Zeus, who blinds us, the accursed sprite that she is, flitting through men's heads, corrupting them, bringing down now this one, now that one. Why, even Zeus was blinded by her once, and Zeus is known to stand above all men and all gods. Well, instead of regarding this as a way of shirking responsibility, Achilles accepts this explanation wholeheartedly, and he says, how utterly a man can be blinded by Father Zeus. Now, this is very interesting. We see here that the whole Homeric idea regarding what we should call unconscious urges and drives is explained in the terms of the 10th century, 9th century BC, as intervention by supernatural forces from without. This creature that he speaks of in the 19th book, this Ate, is a very interesting personage. In the later Greek tragedians, the word arte stands for disaster in general. But in the Homeric poems, arte means the state of mind which leads to disaster, the kind of infatuation, the moral blindness, the fact of being carried away, which leads men to do things against their better judgment and even against their rudimentary interests. This is arte. This is the thing which leads us to do all the absurd and preposterous things which we so often find ourselves doing. In a word, the whole theory of Homer is based upon an idea of demonic or divine possession. The gods either intervene directly, or else they intervene by some agent, such as Arte, who is herself a divine being, and they come in and cause us to do these preposterous and dreadful things. But there are also, besides the bad interventions, there are also in Homer good interventions. The supernatural powers come and suddenly help us. And there is a word which occurs very frequently in the Iliad and the Odyssey, which is the word menos, which means power, strength, the accession of some new insight or ability, the capacity to do something hitherto impossible. This will suddenly come upon a man in battle, or it will come upon him in council, giving him wisdom and intelligence. And even animals are capable of menos. A horse can suddenly have a great deal of menos and gallop at a much greater rate than it could before. And so that we see the two sides of what we should call the unconscious self are represented in Homer by two kinds of supernatural interventions, the good intervention and the bad intervention. And as I say, these interventions may either be by some known god, Zeus or Zeus's immediate agent or Athena or any of the other gods, or else it may be by some supernatural god whom one doesn't know, in which case the intervention is spoken of as being caused by a daimon, just a divine being of some kind, just an anonymous god. And the daimon idea, of course, comes right down into classical Greece. Socrates's monitions, the little voice that he heard telling him to avoid doing things which he ought not to do, was the voice of a daimon, a divine being. And it's very interesting to hear what Socrates has to say about these interventions, these irrational interventions coming from what we should call below the threshold of consciousness. He says in one place that the greatest blessings come to us by way of madness, provided always that the madness be given to us by divine gift. So that there is this idea that not only is there a destructive madness, there are several kinds of madness, of course. There's the natural madness due to disease, or there are the various kinds of supernatural madness, the destructive madness brought about by Arte or by one of the gods who wishes to bring us down, or else the helpful madness, which Plato divides into four categories, the prophetic madness, such as is illustrated by the Oracle of Delphi, the Dionysian ritual madness of the orgiastic catharsis, the poetic madness, and the erotic madness. These are the four beneficent madnesses of which Socrates is talking here. And as I say, Homer treats all these irrational parts of our nature, all the things that we just can't explain. I mean, when we say, well, why on earth did I do this? I must have been out of my mind to do it. He explains this in terms of some supernatural possession. And it's worth remarking that this idea of supernatural possession went on exercising a tremendous influence on men's minds and was accepted as a rational explanation of many peculiar forms of human behavior until well on in the 17th century. I happen to have made a study of this matter as it occurred in the 17th century. I wrote a book on the celebrated case of the devils of Loudun, which is the story of a possession, a so-called possession of an entire convent of nuns. And one sees in reading the theologians and moralists and even the most of the doctors of the period that the idea of demonic possession seemed absolutely obvious in those days. And indeed, until one has an adequate theory of the subliminal self of the unconscious, the idea of possession is really completely logical and sensible. It seems to be about the only way in which these strange phenomena can be explained. It's interesting in this context to see how the Greeks dealt therapeutically with many of the psychological problems which we deal with either by drugs or by psychotherapy. For example, anxiety states they found could be dealt with very satisfactorily by getting people to participate in the Dionysiac orgies, which were great dances and which went on for hours and hours until people fell into a kind of ecstasy and even fell down in a state of exhaustion. And later on came the Corybantic dances, which were both cathartic and diagnostic. As far as one can make out, the whole point of the Corybantic dance was first of all to listen to certain types of music, each of which expressed, say, so to speak, the personality of some god. And then by seeing which music the sick person reacted to, it was possible to see who the god was responsible for his possession. And not only then did he enter into the cathartic dance, but at the end of the dance, he performed the requisite rituals and made the proper sacrifices, and so obtained an absolution, which undoubtedly helped towards the consummation of the cure. And this kind of thing, of course, goes on to the present time. I remember last year in Brazil, I had the opportunity of witnessing several Macumba dances. They are called Macumba dances in Rio, and they are called Candomblé in Bahia. These are Brazilian adaptations of West African tribal rites. And it is most interesting to see the obviously therapeutic effects of these things. They are practiced, of course, by the Negroes, who are in an extremely poor economic position and who have a pretty intolerable life of frustration, and who work off on Saturday nights their frustration, not by getting drunk, but in a much more satisfactory manner, by dancing from sunset to the following sunrise and working all this accumulated frustration off in a physical manner. And I would say that the therapeutic results of these Saturday night dancings are equivalent at least to 6 months on the psychoanalytic couch at $50 a time. And the Greeks, of course, did this regularly. This was a part of the what may be called Greek group therapy in Greek times. Now, the history of possession is quite interesting. The people ceased to believe in it. I mean, most educated people ceased to believe in possession towards the end of the 17th century. And there was a curious interregnum when, during the 18th and a good part of the 19th century, there was really no satisfactory explanation for these very odd phenomena, which undoubtedly took place. Either the phenomena were disregarded, or else they were explained, as the French commission which sat on the Mesmer's case, in which Benjamin Franklin took part, explained the phenomena of what was then called mesmerism, which we now call hypnotism, were explained in terms of something vaguely called imagination and dismissed as such. And indeed, it was not until the latter part of the 19th century that, in order to explain the facts of experimental hypnosis and the facts of hysteria, which were being systematically studied in Paris by Charcot and then in Vienna by Breuer and Freud, it was not until quite late in the 19th century that a theory of the unconscious, or the subliminal self, as Myers calls it, as a dynamic force, was developed, and which provided a really, for the first time, a really satisfactory alternative to the possession hypothesis. And we have to make a, I think we, it's important to remark that in his own way, Homer was extremely realistic. He was realistic subjectively, shall we say, and not objectively. Subjectively, he was realistic inasmuch as many of the phenomena of sudden urges or sudden hunches or insights, which even normal people have, are felt as though they were invasions from the outside, as though they were supernatural interventions. And of course, among people in an abnormal state of mind, this sense of being possessed, of being obsessed by external forces, is extraordinarily strong. You have this the phenomena of listening to voices, of seeing hallucinations, and so on. And it is almost impossible for these people not to believe that some alien force is attacking them and trying to get at them. And as a matter of cultural history, it's extremely interesting to see what explanations of this universal and everlasting human phenomenon have been, how they have varied at different ages in terms of the different Weltanschauungs which have been accepted at the moment. For example, the idea of supernatural possession goes on from the time of Homer right through the Christian epoch until at least the 17th century. And then you get another curious moment in history in the middle years of the 19th century, after the rise of spiritualism with the phenomena produced by the Fox sisters in 1848, you get many people regarding these phenomena as due to departed spirits, not as supernatural beings, but as possession by departed spirits. And in modern times, the explanation is very different in most cases. Like most people who have published books and become to some extent public figures, I receive a great many unsolicited letters, vast numbers of which come from the, what I suppose must be called the lunatic fringe, and sometimes one has a sense that the fringe is like that on a Spanish shawl, that there is more fringe than shawl. And a number of these letters, they're very pathetic. I've had, in the last few years, at least a dozen of them, and I'm reminded of it, because just the other day I received one from Sweden, from a gentleman who'd written to me as for long ago as 1952 about the same problem, but exactly the same as many of the other letters, complaining that he was being subjected to a bombardment by some new kind of radio, which he said was in the hands of a group who were, as he describes them, homosexual fascist communists, who were sending out these messages and pumping them into his mind, and the poor man was in this terrible state, and he could get no relief because the Swedish police were in league with them, and the, so on and so forth. And this is a very common phenomenon now, that these experiences, which are felt as invasions, which would have been interpreted in the past as possession by supernatural beings, or possibly as possession by departed spirits, now appear to be possession by some kind of electronic device. And it's very interesting. I mean, it shows that nothing changes, but everything changes. The fundamental experiences remain the same, but the social frame of reference, the cultural frame of reference in which we explain the experiences, varies profoundly from age to age. Now we have to go back again for the moment to Homer, and to see what exactly is the nature of the self. We talked about these deep irrational drives which are produced by the intervention of supernatural beings. But what is the human personality on which these interventions take place? Well, now the interesting thing in Homer is that as far as he is concerned, there is no such thing as a permanent soul. He doesn't speak about this at all. The word psyche is used by Homer, but it's never used in relation to the mind during a person's lifetime. It is used only of the thing which leaves the body at the last breath, and which then becomes the ghost, which is seen by Ulysses in Odysseus in Hades. These ghosts are so insubstantial, they are not personalities at all, and if you remember, they can only be got to communicate with Odysseus after he's fed them with blood. He makes a sacrifice, pours the blood into the trench. The ghosts eat a little blood, drink a little blood, and therefore take on a little materiality and are able to talk with him. And this is the only use of the word psyche in Homer. For the rest, the personality is looked at by Homer very much as many modern empirical psychologists look at it, as a kind of bundle of symbiotic complexes. There are the various, we can enumerate these complexes in Homer. There is the ego, he speaks of the I, which is more or less equivalent to what he calls the nous, the rational side of man. And this is only one person among a group of persons. Then there are the other forces within the personality, while the most important of which are the thumos, which is the organ of feeling, which is in the chest, and which mounts up very often into the nostrils and the head. And then there is the midriff, the phrein, which means mind, organ of passion, life, which is down here. Then, of course, there is the belly plays an important part, as in the Jewish tradition, where the bowels are the seat of compassion, and the heart is the seat of affections. And these various elements of the personality live together in a rather uneasy symbiosis, slightly hostile to one another, but their interactions form the personality. And one of the most interesting facts about the Homeric psychology is that there is virtually no reference to the will. In this, Homeric psychology resembles very much the older Indian psychology, which laid very, very little stress upon the will. And I suppose it seems to us extremely strange that they don't talk about the will, these older psychologists. But if you don't have a unitary controlling soul, then the idea of will doesn't seem to be so very important. And it seems to be possible to get on without the notion of will. I thought of an example, for example, in the marriage service. I mean, the question, dost thou take this woman to be thy wedded wife? And we would say the answer is, I will. But the Homeric hero, if he was being fully logical, would say, well, my thumos and my phrene are all for it. And in spite of the fact that my noos has certain reservations, I will go along with my viscera, all the more so as I can feel definitely the symptoms of possession by Aphrodite, you see. And so that you can then talk about the phenomena of human experience without invoking the idea of the will. Anyhow, the fact remains that the will is simply not there in Homer, nor is it there in most Indian psychology. But there is, as I say, this idea of a multiplicity of semi-independent forces within the mind-body whose symbiosis constitutes the personality. This fact has been commented upon by Professor Nilsson, writing a few years ago in the Harvard Theological Review, where he says the pluralistic teaching about the nature of the soul is founded in the nature of things, and only our habits of thought make it surprising that man should have several souls. And in fact, we do find among many of the primitive, more primitive or earlier civilizations, the idea of a multiplicity of souls, of a group of powers loosely bound together, and not the idea of a unitary controlling spirit. Homer, of course, was not a philosopher, but he was an extremely acute observer. And he was, as I say, in his way, he was very realistic from a subjective point of view. He was realistic. He was what may be called a kind of paleo-empiricist. And in a certain sense, he anticipates the judgment of Hume on the nature of the human being. Hume, who insisted that it was impossible to observe a substantial soul. I think I've written down what his statement is about this. He says that there is no observable self. All that we observe is a bundle or collection of different perceptions which succeed one another with inconceivable rapidity and are in a perpetual flux and movement. Homer doesn't go quite so far in atomizing the constituent parts of man. He talks about these bundles, these larger bundles, the thumos and phrene and so on. And in this respect, his psychology is curiously like the psychology of early Buddhism. It's not so systematic, of course. The early Buddhism is incredibly and painfully systematic. But the early Buddhist idea is, of course, that man is anatta, without a substantial soul, and that he consists of a group of what in Buddhist, in Pali literature, is called skandhas, which are in effect complexes, partly physiological, partly emotional, partly consisting of the appetitive and partly the reflective and intellectual sides of man, and that all the facts of human behavior can be explained in terms of this system of skandhas, just as Homer thought that all the facts of human behavior could be explained in terms of the thumos, phrene, noos, and ego, and so on. Now, so much for the position of Homer, this position that man has no substantial detachable soul, but is this bundle of semi-independent symbiotic forces, half physiological, half psychological. Now, this was the current notion, I suppose, about 800 BC. But about 400 years later, we find that the current notion is entirely different. We find in Socrates and Plato that it's completely self-evident that man has a unitary soul and that this soul is detachable and can survive the death of the body. The question, of course, arises, what was the reason of this for this profound change which took place in these four centuries between Homer and Plato? Well, in the past it was fashionable to say that there had been influences from the Far East, from India. But recent scholarship inclines, I understand, to the belief that the important influences during that period were not from the East, they were from the North. It was in the 7th century that the Greeks first began penetrating into the Black Sea and founded colonies upon its shores and came into contact with the Scythians. And the Scythians practiced a form of shamanistic religion, such as is still practiced in Siberia and Central Asia, or anyhow was practiced until the inhabitants of those parts of the world were converted to Marxism. Now, the interesting thing about the shamanistic religion is this, that the shaman was a medicine man who established contact with the gods. But he did it in a way fundamentally different from the way in which, say, the Delphic oracle, the Pythia at Delphi, established her contact with the gods. The Pythia at Delphi was what the Greeks call entheos. She had a god inside her, and from that, of course, comes the word enthusiasm. She was filled with the god, and the god spoke through her in the first person. Apollo, when he spoke through the Pythia, said, "I," in precisely the same way, of course, as the modern medium speaks with the voice of her control. The Pythia was obviously a medium speaking through whom a control, which may or may not have been entirely outside herself, was speaking. The shaman, on the contrary, did something quite different. He didn't wait for the god to come into him. He went out to look for God. He practiced what in modern mediumistic jargon is called traveling clairvoyance. He went into a trance and got out of himself and moved about the world and came in contact with divine beings and saw what was going on in other places. Now, whether clairvoyance is a fact or not, I don't know. But it is absolutely undoubted that certain people believe it to be a fact and have a capacity for apparently going out of themselves and getting information from distant places and getting into contact with what appear to be divine beings, and also, which is quite important, of getting into contact with previous existences. Because one of the interesting things about the shamans is that they remembered earlier existences as shamans of an earlier date. And this was one of the things which gave them their power to be shamans, that they were in fact reincarnations of people who had had the same power in the past. Now, as I say, the modern scholarship inclines to believe that these shamanistic ideas came down from the Black Sea and began to penetrate into Greece from the 7th century onwards, and that the rise of the Orphic holy men was essentially due to the shamanistic influence, and that in fact such Orphic holy men as Epimenides were shamans imported, who had taken on the characteristics of northern shamanism in Greece and even in the Isle of Crete where Epimenides came from. And there is no doubt at all that the Pythagoras was profoundly influenced by these Orphic holy men and took on from them many features of his system. And in turn, the Pythagoras influenced the later philosophers. In the Pythagorean system, a very interesting fact arises, that instead of regarding reincarnation as the privilege of a very few people, exceptional people, the shamans, it was democratized and made available to all. This had a very profound theological and psychological effect, because reincarnation ceased to be a reward and a source of power, as it had been for the shamans. The shamans could believe it to be a source of power because they had these strange gifts and experienced their own power. But the great majority of people didn't experience any power, lived a very miserable kind of life. And therefore, the implication was that reincarnation was a kind of punishment, that they were living out a life which was, in fact, the hell of previous lives. And we already get, among the people influenced by Orphic thought, the idea of original sin, where the philosophers say that no one is innocent, that all men are evil, are poneroi, as the Greeks say. This idea of reincarnation, which had in its original shamanistic form was for the few and as a kind of reward, becomes a kind of misery and horror from which the one desire is to escape. We find ourselves from the time of Pythagoras on with this new notion of a man with a substantial unitary soul who is actually imprisoned in a body for the offenses which have been committed in earlier lives. And so that we get this this phrase which begins occurring in Greece in the 5th and 4th century, soma sema, the body tomb, body equals tomb, or the other phrase, soma frura, body equals prison, which was absolutely opposed to anything which had ever entered the mind of Homer. The body wasn't a prison, it was just part of the personality. But the result is that with the sort of canonization of these ideas by Socrates and Plato, we get the beginnings of this dualism, which then becomes systematized and made scientific very late on by Descartes, which has haunted Christian thought ever since. You get the rise of this distinction between mind and body, and the sense that the body is very bad, the sense that the spirit is in some way alien to its animal side and to nature in general. It is in fact a semi-Manichaean point of view. And this despite the fact, of course, that Christianity derives from the Hebrew tradition, which is very far from being Manichaean, which completely accepts the life of the body. Nevertheless, the two things run side by side within the Christian tradition, And the Greek side often predominates, this dualistic and puritanical side, which springs from the Orphics and goes on through Plato. It's worth spending a moment or two to discuss the Hebrew point of view in regard to the soul. In the earlier parts of the Old Testament, there is no immortal soul. The rewards take place on this earth, and the soul and body are completely joined. The personality is a mind-body. And just as Homer has no word for the substantial soul, so I understand Hebrew, at the time of the Old Testament, has no word for the general conception of body. I mean, it seems so obvious that the two go together that it's not necessary to make this distinction. On the other hand, of course, they have copious words for the various organs of the body. And in fact, we find in the Old Testament and also in the New Testament that psychological ideas are constantly expressed in physiological terms. For example, Joseph's bowels yearned upon his brother. God's mercy is equated with bowels by Isaiah. St. Paul urges the Colossians to put on bowels of mercies, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, long-suffering. In Philippians, he exhorts his correspondents by the bowels of Christ and speaks of bowels and mercies. And in the Psalms, we get this constant reference to another organ of the body, to the reins, the kidneys. These have a deep psychological meaning. God tries the reins when he tests men's faith. And then again, my reins instruct me. Examine me, O Lord. Prove me. Try my reins and my heart. Thus my heart grieveth, and I was pricked in my reins. And so on. This constant reference to the bodily expressions of personality and conditions of behavior, which run through the Old Testament in a most realistic way. There's a deep, again, a kind of proto-empiricism here, which, as in Homer, stresses the great importance of the physiological side of man. And of course, with the modern developments in endocrinology, we realize that these things are perfectly true. I mean, the reins in the, or rather the little glands on top of them, the adrenals, are of enormous importance to us. That the fact of having more or less adrenaline or noradrenaline in the blood makes a profound difference to our personality. And as we discover now that many of the violent and sudden experiences which seem to us completely irrational and which are experienced subjectively as though they were interventions from outside, are in fact due to these sudden physiological uprushes of chemical materials created within the body. And while we're talking of these chemical body-mind changes, we should also mention the fact of the external chemicals, chemicals taken in from the outside, which can produce these profound effects upon the mind. As a Hausmann said long ago, beer does more than Milton can to justify God's ways to man. And there are many chemicals a great deal more effective than beer. And incidentally, one of the most fascinating bypaths of the history of religion is to trace the use of chemicals in the various religious traditions for the purpose of changing the state of mind and producing what the Greeks called enthusiasm, the sense of God within. Almost all the religious traditions have at one time or another made use of some such chemical mind changers, from wine in the rites of Dionysus to beer in the rites of the Celts, to peyote in the rites of the of many North American Indians. This would take me too far afield to go into this, but these are very interesting and important facts, and the facts which we are beginning to investigate today, and which make us, I think, much more sympathetic with this empirical, semi-physiological way of looking at the mind, at the psychology which was current in the among the Hebrews and in the time of Homer. Well, let us now try to sum up what has been happening. The interesting thing, it seems to me, is that the history of psychology since the time of Homer, and particularly in recent years, has taken the form of a kind of spiral. We begin with the mind-body, this thing which this personality which hasn't got a single controlling soul. We pass then to this idea of a detachable soul, as was developed by Plato. And then in recent years, we seem to have come round again to a position which, so to speak, is above the Homeric position. We've passed from a kind of proto-empiricism to a kind of scientific empiricism, where we're inclined to accept this idea of an inseparable mind-body, and this idea of a personality composed of rather loosely associated elements, which don't necessarily form a single unitary soul. The question, of course, remains whether beneath this Humean or Buddhist arrangement of skandhas, there is some kind of pure ego or Atman, as the Indians say. This is something we shall have to discuss in later lectures. I would like to quote a few words of Bertrand Russell's on the subject. I mean, he's talking about Hume. He says, "From this view of human personality, it does not follow that there is no simple self. It only follows that we cannot know whether there is or not, and that the self, except as a bundle of perceptions, cannot enter into any part of our knowledge." Well, I would be inclined to dispute this, because I think that there probably are methods by which the pure ego or self or Atman can be enter into our consciousness. But this is, a subject which I shall have to talk about in later lectures. In the next lecture, I shall have to talk about the ideas of personality which we have now and which we express in our contemporary terminology. And from there, I shall. It's really a study of the whole idea of the unconscious, which we shall have to go into, and into the whole idea of the relationship between mind and body, the inseparable isomorphy of the two. But meanwhile, we have to bear in mind that, as Russell says, the existence of this loosely conjoined aggregate of powers does not necessarily mean that there is no simple soul, no Atman. It merely means that it's extremely difficult, I wouldn't say impossible, to contact this thing. But this later problem we shall have to leave until we come to the question of the nature of religion. Meanwhile, I say thank you.